I cannot tell you how happy it makes me to come to this intro in a good mood after everything that I've been through in these last couple days working on this. If you'd been following me online, I was talking about how I had been working on this podcast from November 13th, Friday, at the live show we did with Wes Lee at the Shed Barbecue and Blues Joint in Ocean Springs. And I had been working on it for days and getting everything real nice and you know, up to par. And just as I was about to go upload it, my computer just completely crashed. I tried to bring it up and it was just gone. And I had lost everything. It just disappeared. The program specifically told me it was not going to recover the files. So I was pretty crushed, and just some other things that I had happened on that day, besides all that, was just, it was not a good day. And so I came back tonight and I had this idea that maybe I could pull the live recording that we broadcasted, and I should have took pictures, but I just had my microphone next to a stereo system on top of, enclosed in shoe boxes and elevated with books from the library to recapture the broadcasting as I played it back through my phone and then re-recorded it onto the mixer back onto the computer, which I'm about to save immediately after I do this and put it on an external hard drive and keep it safe. So I am so happy to be able to bring this podcast to you now. Granted, it is so kind of complicated. The first 20 minutes is we had an echo problem. I've put that separate piece after post-edit onto a separate segment, which I'm just laboring as the CNP 53 extra talk. So that's the intro. That's some of Wes's roots, his early musical journey. You can listen to this and go back and listen to that, or you can listen to that and go through this, whatever you want to do. But the live broadcasting, we only had an hour of, so I've re-recorded everything after the intro, that first 20 minutes with the echo. This is that. And then what I'm going to do is, once we lost that hour, there was still another 10, 15 minutes that we talked. I'm going to have a gong at the end of the hour, or the 30 minutes, whatever it is that we captured. You're going to be hearing of the good quality. And then I'm just going to put the backup audio that I captured at the shed, going to run on. So it's going to jump in the different audio quality, and that's just going to be the last 10 to 15 minutes. So if you enjoy what you hear of the good quality, just stick in there. You know, it's not terrible. It's audible. So, and you can hear pretty much the whole entire podcast. Thank God. So that being said, I'm just going to give a quick run through of what we did. This was recorded, like I said, at the Shed, and this is with blues musician Wes Lee from Mobile, Alabama, dedicated to blues music this episode, and more specifically, Wes's musical career. We spoke for about an hour, and then we had a side-by-side performance where me and him swapped out doing a mix of original music and old tunes to some of the genre's great players. So I want to definitely thank the Shed for hosting the event, helping us put it on. Special thanks to Fred Salinas for helping us get it together. Some of my other hardworking creative friends that were in the crowd, Johnny Cole and Steve Anderson and Robbie Aminette of the Southland Music Line. One of the great things that also made this day better after I got this all together before all that happened was Johnny Cole and Steve put this great article together about the show with photography, and they put it up on the Southland Music Line. I've shared it on my page. But I highly recommend you go to their page as well and check it out. Give them a like, go to their website and see all the stuff they do. They do tons of stuff for music and music venues all around not just here on the coast, but all around the southern region. Johnny travels everywhere across all different parts of the U.S. I think just a couple weeks back, he was as far up as New York, I want to say. So great guys, and I appreciate coming out. Robbie Aminette did a fantastic job, painted a picture of me and Wes live as we were playing. I have pictures of that up there as well. Of course, we're going to try to get these guys back onto the podcast again. Johnny's been on it twice recently, and maybe in December we're going to do like a music year in review, if you will. Other people in the crowd, I think the tall boy showed up for a while, and so I appreciate you fellas coming out. And of course, big thanks to our family, friends, and fans of the blues who came out to support the show and preserve blues music. So that's it. We're going to get right into it. Please, if you enjoyed the podcast or enjoyed the show, remember to go and check us out on the Coastal Noise Facebook page. Give us a like, follow me, Stephen Lawson, on social media. And I'm sure if you go to Wesley's page or Wesley Music and give him some love there, give him a like, he'd appreciate it too. So thank you all. This is the Coastal Noise Podcast, episode number 53 with Wes Lee, live at the Shed Barbecue and Blues Joint in Ocean Springs, Mississippi.
And so I force myself into these games where I don't do that. You know, I have to play somewhere else. Or I'll put the guitar in a different tuning altogether and go, and I'll make something.
Yeah. Good, bad, or ugly. Yeah, I found that that's a really interesting method that has resulted in some really weird, messed up songs.
Yeah.
I'm going to play one tonight, and it came out of this night where I was just retuning my guitar strings, and this has become kind of a habit now. Every time I want to retune my strings, I will just randomly just tune them down, drop them nasty low, get that E string so that it's slapping bass, and
right.
it won't even be on a whole or half, it'll be somewhere in between. I'll take some of the strings out and just start playing, and you know, just look for something out of that, go, you know, what can I make out of this, you
right.
know, because I feel like in terms of blues music, that's a lot of what that kind of stuff is, and people will try to recreate and go, man, what is this guy playing, or how is he doing that, or how is he recreating that sound? And and it's just one of those things. It's like, well, that's just what they did that day, and God loving, we got it on record somehow, you know.
Right.
So and like when you pick up a guitar, like if you want to get a new guitar or something like that, does it have to really strike you in a certain way for you to want to take it home?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. A lot of times I find all of a sudden I'll have I got this idea. I got this thing happening, you know, and so something will start happening. I got this. And that's the way it goes. And then, you know, next thing you know, I got another guitar. Sometimes I've gotten better about not buying gear, you know, but I'm still a big gearhead.
Yeah. Well, can we talk about your gear for a second?
Sure.
I see you're a pretty big fan of Resophonic guitars, as
I am.
Understand. Why is that?
They were just, they speak to me.
Mm-hmm.
They speak to me. You know, my favorite hot rods are the old Fords with the flatheads.
Okay.
And they ruled the earth before the overhead, you know, Chevrolet engines came and all that. They ruled the earth, and there was a sound to them, and just the way they, you know, that thing about them.
Mm-hmm.
And the Resophonic guitars, the National Resophonic guitars, were made to compete with orchestras, to compete with combo bands, big bands,
mm-hmm.
because the guitars of the time were archtop guitars. You know, the Dreadnought had not been invented yet, so all the guitars were these small little parlor-sized guitars, or they were archtops and were beautiful guitars, but they were lost in an orchestra, and there wasn't electronics, mm-hmm. right? And so these guys came up with a way to do this, and so that they were, you know, they were hulking, and they were big and loud, and they could keep up, and when I played them, man, just spoke to me, and I was loud enough that I could be obnoxious without plugging into anything, and I just, oh man, just get all over this,
mm-hmm.
and it was the sound, because I play with a pretty heavy mid-range tone. To me, that's where the magic of the guitar voice actually lies. You know, you listen to Stevie Ray, or you listen to Duane Allman. You know, those guys, they used that mid-range to their advantage and really cranked it up more than you would actually think they would to be able to get that sustain and stuff. And then and Jimmy did it too. But so that sound kind of played into what my ear, you know, and maybe that's from listening to all these old records that, you know, had, they were very mid-rangey, you know. Mm-hmm. So maybe that kind of went into it, but that was just kind of my voice. And then, and they just, it felt right, mm-hmm. you know. I have it, like I said, I still have my first guitar. I still record with it. It doesn't go out on the road very much anymore. But I still play it all the time. It's sitting in the studio. It's out. I mean, it's there recording, being beat on still. But the Resophonic guitars, just they just speak to me, and they're a good voice for me, and my voice fits well within what they do. You know, I feel like they complement each other very well. And then when I have the baritone that's tuned way down, really, really big and low, so it has just all this hulking bottom into it and this pretty shimmer on top. So it's still very, very pretty. And then as I got into listening to, you know, Sunhouse, you know, I found Sunhouse before I found Buka White. And but, I mean, listening to those guys, man, it's just like,
yeah, I found Buka White's Aberdeen, Mississippi Blues about a year or two ago.
Yeah.
This video, black and white video of this guy playing this guitar,
hard
rock. This resonator guitar and singing in this nasty voice.
Yep.
That was just beautiful. He's this big guy, Buka White is, and he's playing, and he does this thing where he starts. Slapping the guitar, it's resonating really nicely because it's a resonator guitar,
yep.
and he's hitting the body and slapping the fretboard,
yep.
and he's keeping time and he's singing,
yep.
and then he goes right back into it, you know, finger picking, and then he incorporates a slide into it,
right?
And it's just I showed some of my friends and they're just like, what is this? And
yep.
like, that's what used to be.
Right.
That's where it came from.
That's
you know?
It.
And that's what Led Zeppelin's copied, you know?
Absolutely. And then he flips it into his lap and pulls out his pocket knife.
Yeah, just, yeah.
Starts whittling on it, you know? Like, oh, man, this guy's getting after it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. All those guys. There were so many of them, you know? Furry Lewis, you know, he'd play over the top with his thumbs. So he'd be playing bass lines with, you know, and then he'd play it with his elbow. He'd be rubbing his elbow up and down, you know. Charlie Patton played behind his head, played between his legs, you know. I mean, before it was cool to do any of that, you know. Mm-hmm. These guys, I mean, they were showmen as well, right? But the sounds of these guitars. And Charlie didn't. Charlie played a Stella, but mm-hmm. ladder braced. Stella Parlor guitar. When he got some money, he had the whole guitar covered in mother of pearl.
Yeah. Nothing too flashy.
Nothing too flashy.
Mother, humble.
Keep it real. Yeah, but Charlie, man, he's one of my favorites. And because he played everywhere, and I read somewhere, I don't know if it's true or not, but I read somewhere that he recorded more sides than any of them.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he took Robert Johnson's place at Carnegie Hall when they found out Robert Johnson was dead. And but his whole thing where no matter how these fancy places that he played, he liked playing at Dockery and he liked playing these juke parties and stuff. He liked playing for the common man. He, you know, or considered common man. That's what he enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
That was where his heart really was. You know, he knew that they got it, and he just had the most fun there.
Mm-hmm.
And do it. So it was. Hey, it was cool to go put on the suit and go do that, and then come back and do this. And
mm-hmm.
he's cool about it.
Yeah.
So that's why and he's really hard to pull into a repertoire. You know, I sound checked on one of his songs. Or,
oh yeah.
And yeah. That's, you know, Charlie's fun to play.
And you know, he's one I've never really gotten into very much. I haven't
really
dived into a lot of his records or anything.
You check some
which,
of that out.
You know, I can't believe I haven't. As many people reference him, you know. I mean, he's one of the oldest greats, you know.
Right. He's where it came from. I mean, he's the father, you know, he's considered, you know, the father of mm-hmm. that. You know.
So we probably have less do we have less on him than what we have, you know, like Robert?
Well, yeah, there's one picture of him. There's two pictures of Robert Johnson. There's just a bunch of sides of Charlie.
Yeah.
You know, but not really any.
That shows how much more technology advanced in those periods, you know, absolutely. Two pictures
right.
in that guy's era. Yeah, so.
Right, right. And now there's three known of Robert. You know, they found that other one of him and Johnny Shines. Have you seen that?
Mm-mm.
Oh, yeah. And I'll shoot you a picture of it.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, that's cool. I'll send that to you. A guy bought it off eBay. It was being auctioned off like it's early B.B. King, and whoever bought it was like, that's not B.B. King. And they had some whole forensic thing documenting it, and that's a neat little backstory.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, what's even cooler is the Ground Zero gets even smaller because Charlie Patton was related to the Chapman Boys of the Mississippi Sheiks.
Okay, I'm not aware of them.
He was cousin. The Mississippi Sheiks? Oh, man, that was the Bo Carter, Sam Chapman. And they were all... So if you go back, when you start going down the rabbit hole, it all starts going back even from boom, 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 and get smaller and smaller and smaller. And holy crap, all these guys were related here. This is where this was, and mm-hmm. they were related. I mean, and it's amazing. And the Mississippi Sheiks, they were more of a jug band blues, right? So they had, you know, guitars and fiddles and banjos, washboards, right? All the stuff, and jugs. And they played all over the place, and they did all sorts of stuff, and they were all sorts of sides. And one of these songs, and I'm gonna play it tonight because I did it with the Jericho Roadshow, and I picked it up to do with my friend Libby Ray Watson because Libby Ray is the Mississippi version of Bonnie Raitt. That's the way I consider her because she went up to the Delta and she went and found all these guys and she sends me videos of like Napoleon Strickland like playing her national. You know, back when Alan Lomax came down in the 70s and did all those documentaries and stuff. And she was there. She studied with these guys and knew all these guys. And so she's just like this fabulous resource to be around. And beyond that, she's a great friend. And so when you mentioned the Jericho Roadshow, the famous picture of Mr. Sam, Steve Gardner took.
Yeah,
right. It's our buddy in Japan, right? Wow. And so then the other cat, Bill Stieber, you see all these faces in these pictures and all this, you know, all over the place. Bill took those pictures, a lot of them. He's been a photojournalist for so long. And so you start hearing and then just being around them and what they're talking about. And, you know, the story time after the show is when the show really started because yep. he'd start going and telling all this stuff. But when I was going to go out we were going to do that tour, I picked up some Mississippi Sheik songs. And so I pitched them to them and they were like, yeah, we got to do that. That'll be great. So that's what we did. And so then they start telling you about, you know, what was going on or what, you know, so-and-so told them, you know, later in life, right? And some of the stuff that they do, man, today they would say, oh, that's Appalachian music. But that was created here in Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so, and it's just they probably were over on a tour, right, going to play somewhere, and they heard another group, you know, and that what did you say earlier, cross pollination,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it just gets mixed up, and then you got the stuff coming from New Orleans, and you know, all this stuff coming up the Mississippi, helps Highway 61, and the whole deal, man. And then Bo Carter, he wrote all these innuendo songs that are absolutely hilarious. Banana in your fruit basket. And, you know, it's just hilariously funny songs, but, you know, they're appropriate, you know. But it's an amazing journey to get as you start going, oh, man, this guy, you know, here and then this and this. And then the song that I was playing earlier for soundcheck, when your way gets dark, turn your lamp up high.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that line, zum-ba-ba-da-da-dum, right? That's the main line. That line was used in a Robert Johnson song, in a Muddy Waters song, in Howls, and they all got it from him. Because every one of those guys talks about Charlie Patton.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that lick.
Yep.
And that's the coolest thing. So you can, you know, you're just tracing it. Yeah, you know, finding the root.
Mm-hmm.
Finding the root.
Yep. Man, you look really warm in that jacket. I'm going to grab mine, okay?
Okay.
All right, give me a second.
How y'all doing out there?
Yeah, everybody doing good? Yeah, everything's good. Everybody staying warm?
Good to see you, Andy.
You too.
Well, thank you, man.
All right. Yeah, we're outside, folks, so there's a chill. But at least we got, or I do at least, you got the inner earbuds. I've got the over ear, so the ears are warm at least. But, yeah, that's a wonderful thing, especially, I mean, you've pretty much grown up in, have you always lived in the South, always in this area?
Mm-hmm. I spent a little over a year living in Minnesota.
Okay. Yeah, so it's really nice to be able to, you know, to love the blues as much as you or I do, and it comes from right here in Mississippi.
Right.
Or at least the general area.
Yeah, but, it was a little more polished. In Mobile. But, you know, and they had things like, you know, it was called different stuff. It was called the Mobile Boogie, you know. Well, it's, you know, it's the same kind of a deal. It's got its own little twist. It's just like, you know, an East Side Shuffle, a West Side Shuffle, a Kansas City Shuffle is different from a Chicago Shuffle, which is different from a Texas Swing, which is different from an Uptown thing. You know, I mean, they're all different, right? But they're all still the same.
Mm-hmm.
So, here we are in this area, and we have all of these artists, all of these people, and all of this music that's from here.
Mm-hmm.
And here being this region, right? I mean, that's pretty heavy.
Yeah.
Exported, came back, right? Reintroduced, you know. They took Buka and all these guys, took them to Europe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's amazing. I mean, it really is amazing.
Sure.
It's a fabulous, fabulous thing. And it's very cool to go somewhere. I'll go places, and yes, I have a bad, or it's not bad, but I have an accent. I have a big accent. And, you know, some places, they just want to hear me talk and hear me tell some story about something just, you know, because I talk funny. You know, so, you know, that's cool, too.
Going back to your equipment, I wanted to ask you, you know, you've done a lot of live shows, and I always, when I go to a live show, it's kind of like trying to figure out a jigsaw puzzle in mm-hmm. terms of, like, where everything goes, and what's it like for you when you go into a space? I mean, are you pretty well in tune with how you're going to set up and what you're going to do at this point? I mean, it's...
I'm a lot more that way now. Mm-hmm. Used to, you know, it was, I was going to take, especially like if I, in the sense of an electric band, when I was playing with a group, then I got to the point where when I first started, you know, it was like, this is the amplifier that I have, and I turn it on 10, and your ears are going to bleed or they're not. It's either going to be big enough or not enough, you know? So, you know, but I had to get over that. And then by the time I was not traveling or leaving one electric band, heading for a new experience, I was carrying a multitude of amps. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I showed up somewhere, oh, this is a little amp room, you know, I would be prepared like that. As the solo guy and knowing what it is that, you know, what I want to have and what I want to hear, because what I want to hear affects the way I play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm not feeling it, if it doesn't sound good, you know, there's a certain part. You don't let it rattle you, and you don't let it obscure from your performance. But at the same time, you know that you could, you know, it's just you're maybe working too hard. If I can't hear that monitor, man, I'm pushing my voice a lot harder, which may or may not be a good thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I use my feet. I'm beating on these guitars. So I came to a thing where I show up. This is my plan. You know, I'm going to run my own rig. This is what I do, and I'll give you a line to the sound guy. And if that doesn't work out, and you feel you can do, you need more control or better control, then that's fine. We can do that as long as you can be accommodating to what I have to have.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've found myself where I can roll into a festival and they have no problems with my duffel bag and my guitars on my shoulder, and boom, here it is. You know, it takes me 10 minutes to set up, 5 to tear down, mm-hmm. you know, and roll. So it works for me. You know, I've come to know what, okay, this is what I want to have. This is what I want to hear. This is, you know, and with unless it's the addition or subtraction of guitars, mm-hmm. you know, if I'm really feeling my oats, you know, I may carry a whole bunch of guitars so I don't have to retune at all. You know, but most of the time now I carry 3, and then there's a backup for everything. For every piece of gear that's on the stage, there's a backup.
Oh, okay.
I carry backups for, well, with the exception of the guitar stand, but I have a backup of everything. Mm-hmm. So, because you never know when something's going to quit. You know, so I felt like that. You know, okay, so it's budgeted that, you know, I have to have this. Mm-hmm. You know, so.
I want to ask you about your albums. 8 studio albums makes for a pretty strong catalog of music. What has that experience of recording your music in the studio been like over the years?
It's it went from a small first studio. The first studio that I recorded in my music was about the size of this stage. Drums were over there. I'm sitting in the tracking room, where that closet is. That was a ISO booth for a vocal, and my guitars, my amps went in there. Bass played direct. We were all in the same room, but my amps were isolated. Drums were isolated. Bass went to a DI into the board. It was cut really fast because we didn't have a whole lot of time. So that was a. You know, it was cool. It was quick, down and dirty, but it was a neat experience. The second record, Anything But Wrong, we did that all over the place. We did that all over the South, and it was all done with, you know, you're playing at a club, and a guy goes, "Well, I got the studio, man. You know, I like to make records, man. You know, okay, we're done at 1. We can be over there by 2, and so we would go and play till dawn, and then, you know, we'd be gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so we might do a track here and a track there. So I called it the Love and Happiness record. You know, everybody just kind of, you know, this guy's wanting to do. And that was a fun record to make.
Mm-hmm.
And that record was really where the first record was done in a style that I knew we could get work. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So it was all written to, okay, if I play this way, with this sound, with these patterns, we can go get a gig. Mm-hmm. We can work. And so that was the whole intent, you know, of it. The second record is where I really started going, okay, this is my sound. This is who I am on an electric guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And so it went like that. And then the third album, which was my first solo record. That album came about because one of my songs got picked up by the American Cancer Society. And so I was commissioned to write one, and then they used a pre-existing song, but I had to re-record those. And so we did, one of those is a band track, and the other was just a solo track. So it was for a memorial lap, and then the Survivor Lab. And, you know, that went to, they went to Washington. Those supposedly got played in Washington at the national event.
Yeah.
But, I needed to sell those songs, right? And so I just tagged on. I had been recording with whatever hodgepodge gear that I had. I had been recording live shows, knowing that I needed to do that. And so I showed up at the, it was Good Friday that year, and I showed up over at my buddy Fish's studio and handed him this wad of stuff, you know, and I was like, make a record. And so he was like, man, look, why don't you, I know you got your gear in your van. Just go get it and set up in there and run a set. Just let me have control of it. Don't even, you know. So it was 45 minutes or maybe an hour, and I just ran a set. And, you know, just sitting in the control environment so he could have what he wanted. And so that was fun. It was cool, you know. It came out better than the other stuff that I gave him. Mm-hmm. So for all its flaws and stuff, but it's still raw and you know, it's cool. I like to listen to it every now and again.
Mm-hmm.
And then it moved into the next album was the Shack Sessions. And I recorded it in Greenwood, Mississippi, on a Zoom H4 silver, whatever it is. And I had gone up, it was in like January, February, and I was playing a club there. And I'd gone up and played there a few times, and I came to find out there was a place called Tallahatchie Flats, and they have all these cabins and stuff out there. And the last cabin that's out there on the property is called the Tush Hog. Now, it does not matter what story that you follow of Robert Johnson. All the different, you know, oh, he did this, he did this, he got stabbed, he got poisoned, he got, you know, right? Does not matter. The end, he got buried, right? The man that dug Robert Johnson's grave was Tush Hog. And supposedly that's his shack that's up there. Well, I drove up there, and it was just terrible conditions driving up there. Ended up getting snowed in. Couldn't get on the street. Well, I had that recorder, and I'm in this cabin. And so I moved all the furniture out, and I put the thing up against the wall in the corner, like they said Robert played. And I just sat there and played all day. I turned the heater on, that gas rattling here. And I turn it on and let it warm up to about 50 degrees in there. And then I turn it off and I'd go back and I'd play. And I did that all day. Mm-hmm. And came away with, and all I did was just play songs that because I had nothing written, you know, in mind to go and do that, right? And so it was just songs that, like, when I was learning this style, this is what, you know, this is the way I played it. This is the way I approached it. So it was all about, to me, it was all about just the moment, just season the moment, season that right there, you know. And so I came home, and I was pretty happy with it, you know, the way it was. And so we put it out, and I went back over to Fisher's studio and handed him. I said, but this time I got this thing, you know. And he goes, all right, well, that's a step up. And so he made it, you know, he made it sound like a record. And then we did, the next one was Six Pack of Soul.
So that one was the fourth one.
Yep.
Okay.
And so, but it was really cool because it was on the 100th anniversary, right? I released it on, you know, Robert's May anniversary of his 100 year anniversary and stuff. And so, you know, it was a big deal to me, you know, because I showed up and I went back up there and I was playing these couple of little festivals that they had going on. And it was, you know, I could say this, you know, I don't mean to sound ugly when I say this, but one of the things was, like, they were talking all about this stuff and these artists and blah, 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 that didn't know crap about what Money Road was and you know, all this. And I just held up my CD at one point and said, well, I recorded my record at where Robert Johnson, the man that buried his house, is. I had nothing else to say. That kind of said it all, you know. Good, bad, or ugly, I had this piece that I had done on the centennial year. Mm-hmm. Can't take that away from me.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so, it's, you know, that was cool. So then we moved on to the, I had all these songs written. I love Memphis. I love Memphis music. I always have that Memphis sound, man. And so we did Six Pack of Soul, which is my tribute to Memphis. And it's one of the only new records that I have that has a full band on it. And so it was a full band, nine piece, horns, everything. We tracked it in the blazing heat. And it took, we worked on that record for a while, just getting the mixes right and getting everything right. But I had, you know, had some of the Memphis horns play on it. It was cool. Just relationships that I've developed going back to, all these old guys that I went and hung out with and would play with and learn stories by and get yelled at and stuff. And then I go, well, I'm making this record. Oh, here they come. You know, hey, man, I'll play on it for you. Yeah, please. So, you know, wow, that's cool. You know, and I got that sound, and I'm really proud of that record. And it's the only record that I've had that I've sold out three pressings of as an independent. And for me, that's pretty killer.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's been pretty commercial. It was, you know, very much more commercially accepted because of that sound. You know, it's that thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been fun. That was fun. That was a lot of fun. That was more of a labor of love. You know, you don't make any money on that one. But that led me to doing Wood and Steel. And Wood and Steel, I recorded in Bogalusa, Louisiana, at Studio in the Country. And one of the things that I am most, when I look at pictures of things that I've done and places I've been and all this and being around the history of this, that cover photo was taken. I'm sitting at Professor Longhair's piano, and he's one of my guys. I mean, that whole studio was built around him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, Stevie Wonder recorded there, you know, Kansas, Dust in the Wind. I mean, all these fabulous, fabulous records were cut in that space. And here's this little old guy who's still at it and went and did it. And so that was real cool. And my whole journey has been that invest in yourself. Always invest in yourself. Always reinvesting in yourself. Don't just blow the money. You make enough to live on, but you got to reinvest yourself. Look at where we're sitting. These guys reinvested in themselves numerous times. The place burns down, they reinvest in themselves, and they go, no, we're going back and we're doing this, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a constant thing with whatever you do. You're constantly reinvesting in what you do. So my whole journey of making music is that, you know, well, someday I'm going to have my own studio. Someday, it's not going to be for anybody else. It's going to be for me. That's all it's, I just want it for me. I want it to sound the way I want it to sound, and so it's going to be me. And so that, I recorded 5 of the 6 songs on Wood and Steel at Studio in the Country. The 6th song I recorded, and that was my mix. And it was it sounds different than everything else on the record, the tone of that song, the bigness of the guitars, the whole, everything about it. And that was a signature of what's coming next. Mm-hmm. And so we did that. And then Blue Room was all mine. I reinvested, and it took me 3 or 4 years to get all the money together to have my own space and have my own place to record my music and the way I wanted to record my music, the medium in which I wanted to record my music. And so Blue Room was mine. That was mine. I did it all.
Blue Roo. I butchered that pronunciation.
That's okay, man. That's okay. Yeah, you know, Blue Rock.
They spell it, you know.
R-O-U-X, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, my dad said, what is that? What is that? And I was like, well, it's the stuff you use in cooking, man. It's the brown sauce. I don't know what that is. So.
Okay, well, I'm not the only one.
It happens to everybody.
Well, so. We're going to lose our live feed for in about a minute here. So for anybody who wants to hear the rest of the conversation, it'll be on coastalnoise.com at a later point in time. So just throwing that out there before we get on. But I do want to hear more about your studio here with Blue Roo.
Mm-hmm.
So what was that's a totally different process than now that you have your own space and you've kind of created this environment for
right.
yourself to create this.
And I played all the instruments on that record.
Oh, okay.
I did everything on that record. It was all me. And then I had a couple of friends come in and put ears on things and help me, you know, do things. But yeah, that was predominantly, it was all, you know, it was where I was heading. It's where I was wanting to go. And that's the other part of where we are technology-wise, because you can get on the YouTube and you can watch people and you can talk like, you know, I love Derek Trucks as a modern-day guitar player. And Derek is the epitome of that. Reinvest in yourself. Warren Haynes, reinvest in yourself. Always, always, always reinvest in yourself. So it's that whole, you know, it's just the whole mentality of making it, You know, this is, you don't owe anybody anything on it. You know, and so now you can be free to do whatever it is that you want to do, and you can have this, and hopefully people will like it, right? But you're not, if they don't, well, you can just jump right back in there and go do something else, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that was that's been a cool thing. And then, so that whole concept and just doing it and doing it and doing it. And then when you think you got it, do it again. Mm-hmm. and just try to do the best that you can all the time.
Never be completely satisfied, right?
No.
Okay, so that was the end of our broadcast there that I got from the live recording. There's about 8 more minutes left that I'm going to play now from the backup audio files. Lesser quality and a couple buzz and hums, but otherwise pretty good stuff. So go ahead and just finish running on out, you know what I'm saying? Thanks for listening.
What has been
that never goes away. Even when I'm really, really beat down and tired, we all get beat down and tired. No matter, it doesn't matter what you do, you get beat down and tired. I mean, you know, doesn't matter if you're the world's greatest football player. You know, you get beat down and tired. Everybody does.
Yeah, probably more so than
me. Right. I mean, it happens. You know, hard day at the office. There's always tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, we're gonna go do it again. I never even question that. You know, sometimes I question it. But, music will always be there. Music will always be there. So I'll never even, it's not even a question in my mind of anything. The challenges are, continuing to get paid for it, continuing to find venues, getting into those venues. I mean, it's a difficult thing. That is a full-time job. So, I often go, man, I'd really like an agent. That paying somebody 20%, man, you could do that. So, that's the big one. That's the big challenge. Finding time to be a one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest. That's the challenge. Just doing the best that you can do, And, I continue to go back to Freddie King, B.B. King, Albert King, Muddy Waters, Howell, pick one. Those guys were not doing it for stardom. Those guys were working guys, putting food on the table. That's what they were doing. That was their job. I gotta go clock in. It just happens that my trade and my job is playing music, right? And writing songs and doing that. So it was never, those guys, it was never really about fame. Right, right. Man, I went and played in West Point. And so when I was there at West Point, that's where Hal Wolf was from. The Hal Wolf Museum was there, Richard Ramsey was there. And I was in there talking to him. And he was showing me these pictures, these old pictures. And can you imagine, number one, you have 5 or 6 guys in a station wagon. That's first off. The second thing, you travel with your own upright piano strapped to the top of the car. Right? Come on, man. Yeah, that's how they did it. Boom. Up on top of the car, tied it off, and went to the next gig. Oh, come on. I mean, that's a working guy, right? So, I mean, golly. There's a lot of, there's so many other factors to all that. I'm talking to guys with icons, right? I love the Muddy Waters story where I went to England the first time. Everybody talks so great about it. I went to England the first time and I got booed. they don't print that story anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But he went by himself and they wanted an electric band and they booed him. And he went back with an electric band and they wanted an acoustic band. Yeah, those were his first 2 trips over there. Yeah, it was not what these guys provided for their band. Howard Wolf, man, He drove himself to Chicago. Bought a truck, drove to Chicago. Had a house, it was just a house. So, you know, it was a brick house. Chicago brick house. Basement downstairs. When he got sick, you know, he died of kidney failure. And so his daughter was talking about how hard he worked. He worked 3 gigs a day, you know, and then do a session at night, you know, all the stuff. I mean, so, man, it's like these guys, they're heroes because of what they gave us in terms of their music, but they're also heroes for the work ethic and just not gonna quit ever. One foot in front of the other. Go, go, go. Right? They talk about their grannies and grandpas. What's the blues? Just keep living.
You're going to find out.
You're going to find out. It's going to happen to you. It's a powerful thing, man.
Mm-hmm. Well, hey, man. Real quick, let me tell you where you're going to be playing next.
Well, we should. In about 15 minutes.
Get down here. What else? What, you got in the near future, you got something else to put on your plate?
In the rest of the year, I'm headed off to North Alabama, over into Georgia, and Indiana, and then come home. Yeah, so next year really starts reaching out again.
Okay. Yeah. Where can people go to keep up with you?
Both Facebook pages, Wesley and Indiana on Facebook. My website is wesleymusic.com. Instagram, and, you know, all social media stuff. YouTube kind of happened. My son is helping me keep that up to date and putting videos on and doing stuff. We're starting to have a good time with that. So I'm out there.
Good deal. Thanks for playing and having a chat with me.
Thanks for having me.
So let's go ahead now and transition and show folks what you got.
Yeah? All right, let's do it. Right. Let's have some fun.
All right, thanks everybody for joining us. Go to GoToys.com if you want to hear any more of the podcast. Go to the Facebook page, all that good stuff. So thanks. See you next time. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, man.
Sorry, I ramble a lot.
Hey, this is what we're here for.
That was fun. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, dude. Okay.